So the Sloan Schwartz Center for Theoretical Neurobiology here at the Salk Institute is very pleased to have Jack Cowan back for his second lecture, which is going to continue on with his analysis of large-scale networks, except from a different perspective. And this is a perspective that I first came across when I was a graduate student at Princeton in the physics department. And at that time, the work that was being done in modeling networks was really at a very early stage. This was pre-Hopfield. And in fact, in many ways, the Hopfield network should be called the specialized Wilson-Cowan network, which is to say it was an analysis of some modeling work that Jack had done much earlier. And he had always wanted to generalize it in the area of statistical analysis. And this is something that was a strong interest that I had. But he said, well, we're working on the problem. We should have something next year. And he's been saying that for the last 25 years. But he finally has it. And so we're really excited to hear his version one. Okay, we've seen that his projects tend to have many versions, but I think this is really an important milestone. And we'll be hearing from Jack, who is in the Department of Mathematics at the University of Chicago, tell us about work that he's been doing on statistical neural field theory.
Could you turn off the yes. lights on over there? Well, thanks very much, Terry. So this is our work that I've done over the last... So in the mid-60s, I introduced the sigmoid model in neural modeling and wrote an equation that essentially was the same equation that 15 years later John Hopfield looked at, except when I did it, I studied the case with antisymmetric weights. And the reason was that the eigenvalues of an antisymmetric matrix are imaginary, and therefore it provided a theory of coupled oscillators. And I built it from excitatory-inhibitory oscillators and coupled them together and was able to do a primitive statistical mechanics from that. But it didn't really allow one to calculate properly the quantities. So then I developed a continuum approximation with Hugh Wilson, which became the Wilson-Cowan equations, which is a nice mean field model. Then John noticed that if you studied the symmetric weight case of my equations, you got an analogy with a spin glass, which was a very neat idea. When I did it earlier, spin glasses hadn't been invented, and I knew I should find something like that, but I never followed it up enough. And I never followed up the sigmoid model in the context of the perceptron, and that was another thing I should have done. But anyway, that had to wait until 1986 or 80. When did you do the stuff with Jeff? The Boltzmann machines. So basically, starting from about 83, the sigmoid model turned out to be one of the key ingredients to actually solving the credit assignment problem for perceptrons. And so it's actually a very useful model. Since 1973, I've been trying to extend the mean field model to include correlations and fluctuations and study what goes on near critical points. Because the mean field model is no good near critical points. And that only became apparent in the 1990s when Softee and Koch produced an interesting paper about the anomalously large fluctuations they measured in spontaneous spiking patterns. And triggered by Per Beck's work, a lot of people started looking at so-called self-organized critical models for neural networks and power laws and stuff like that, all without any foundation, with no real basis for saying anything like that. And what I'll show you is that there is critical behavior in neural networks, but it's not self-organized critical. You have to pick the parameters. It's just like standard statistical mechanics. You have to tune the system in order for it to exhibit phase transitions. So you have to add extra constraints to the system to get self-organized criticality, and we haven't done that yet. Anyway, I had a succession of graduate students who worked with me on these problems, Bart Ehrmantraut, and then much later, Toru Ohira, where we formulated an early version of what I'm going to show you. And that actually I published just before I started working with Toru. I published the first version of this in about 1991 in NIPS, in the NIPS proceedings. But over the last 3 years, I've been working with another very bright physics graduate student, Michael Bice, who's just gone off to Carson Chow's lab at NIH. And this is basically a first version of the full story now, with where we actually can answer all the questions I was trying to ask. The problem is there's a lot of stuff in here. So I have to give you a very technical lecture in such a way that you can understand some of it. And so this is a real problem for me. I've actually given a couple of versions of this without really having the results, and they've been disasters, basically. So hopefully this time I can say things that actually are useful and not just formalism. So here's the story. Let's go back. So the early work of Craig and Temperley and am I going to get a whistle from the two microphones here? So anyway, I basically have outlined the context. And so the mean field stuff gives rise to all sorts of nice things. The hallucination story that I talked about yesterday. Some of the stuff on forest fire analogies I talked about last time I was here, and epileptic seizure models and stuff like that. There's a lot of work goes on the mathematical analysis of the bumps and breather solutions that Hugh Wilson and I discovered numerically 35 years ago. But none of this these studies includes the effects of fluctuations and so on. In order to do this, then, the thing I have to show you first is how you represent Markov random walks and Markov random fields as path integrals, because that's a key. This is the key idea. We're going to set up the evolution of neural activity as a Markov process, but actually we're going to take the thermodynamic limit of that. In other words, we're going to let our network have an infinite number of neurons, and then we're going to take the continuum limit. So we're going to put it into a continuum formulation. So we'll end up with a Markov random field. And then I want to show you how you can analyze Markov random fields. That's how we're going to proceed. So let's first look at the master equation for a random walk on a lattice, d-dimensional lattice. So you can write a master equation. You look at all the transitions into the state x and all the transitions out of the state x, and you do your bookkeeping, and you can end up with an evolution equation. And then if you take the diffusion limit of that equation, in other words, you let the spacing between the neurons go to zero, you let the time go to zero as well, the time constant, but in such a way that L squared over T remains finite, then you get the diffusion approximation to the random walk. And the person who really carried this out mathematically properly, and Eugene, rigorously, was Norbert Wiener. And it was Norbert who introduced the mathematical ideas of Brownian motion and the diffusion limit. Although it was Einstein and Smoluchowski who first studied these problems in the context of physics, and Bachelier in the context of finance, it was actually Norbert who really nailed down the mathematics of it sometime in the 20s and 30s. And since I was one of his students, I learned it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So anyway, what Norbert did was to show, of course, the solution of the diffusion equation is just the well-known Gaussian propagator or Green's function, and it satisfies the Chapman-Kolmogorov equation, which means that if you have random walks and you start from one point and you end up at a second point, it doesn't matter which path you take; they're all will all get you to the same. So the whole process is path independent, and that means you can slice up the process into smaller and smaller increments of time. Every one of them has a Gaussian propagator, but the product of Gaussians is the sum of a Gaussian, so you can actually produce what Norbert called a functional or path integral. So here's the solution of the diffusion equation expressed as a path integral with respect to what Norbert called a measure, the normalized Wiener measure. And now you can add an external force, for example, something that's the gradient of a minus the gradient of a potential function, and you find that that also turns up in the solution for the propagator in an external force. And now you can write that in a simpler form. You can write it as the path integral of the exponent of a quantity called the action, which looks very like the integral of T plus V in classical mechanics, the Hamiltonian. And in fact, it is. It's close related to the Hamiltonian density of classical mechanics. But now it's for random walks. And then the nice thing is, and the important thing is, that you can express correlation functions. The average path, the sum over all paths of functions like x at time t1 times x at time t2 and so on, n-point correlation functions, you can express those as path integrals. And so you can introduce the moment-generating functional, a generalization of moment-generating function in statistics, which is nothing more than the path integral associated with the exponent of the integral of jx, but that's just like a Fourier transform. It's just like the characteristic function in ordinary statistics, and in fact, that's what it is. And so by functionally differentiating the moment-generating functionals, you get all the moments. And you can also get what are called cumulants from the same way by looking at the log of z. So this is all standard stuff that's very well known. And in case of Gaussian Markov random walks, if you actually have a Gaussian propagator, as you know, all the higher moments all depend upon the first two moments. So everything collapses, and the moment-generating function for a Gaussian Markov random walk depends only on the two-point correlation function, assuming the one-point function is zero. And that's a result of what is known in physics as Wick's theorem, that for even moments, the endpoint moment function or the two-endpoint moment function collapses to the sum of products of all the two-point functions you get by partitioning the integers from one to n, and so and the odd moments vanish. So this is this result is actually the key to Feynman diagram calculations and quantum field theory. Because basically, what Wick also showed was that the Schrodinger equation, if you go to imaginary time in the Schrodinger equation, it becomes the diffusion equation. So the mathematics of quantum mechanics is actually identical to the mathematics of random walks, except for one very important difference. In random walks, the probability sums to one. But in quantum mechanics, the square of the modulus of the wave function sums to one. So apart from that trivial mathematical difference, the two theories are identical. But of course, the whole of the physics is contained in that trivial different mathematical difference. In quantum mechanics, you have entanglement phenomena and non-local action. In Brownian motion, you don't. My contention is the mathematics of the brain does not show quantal phenomena because it doesn't have this norm, but it does show all the things you see in Gaussian Markov processes or Brownian motion.
So this is a model based on the idea that neurons are binary units?
They can be binary or a little more complicated.
But you started out with a d-dimensional lattice, right?
Right.
Or
right.
A hypercubic. And so I guess each dimension is a neuron.
Well, we've got each site in the is going to be represented by a neuron.
And it can either be 0 or 1?
No, it can be more complicated. I'm going to introduce a more continuous way of doing it.
Positive to actively scale it, right? I mean, people who push quantum phenomena really look at a lower scale, don't they?
Yes, they do, but then they forget that you only get real quantum effects at micro scales when things are cold.
Yeah.
The brain is too warm. Okay, so we need only compute two-point correlation functions. But then comes a nice result that comes out of the action, that the correlation function is equal to the propagator, the solution of an ordinary differential equation. And the solution in this case for the potential function we introduced is that the correlation function is just falls off exponentially. And so you're led to the nice result that the moment-generating function in this case is nothing more than the moment-generating function for the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process. So the Gaussian-Markov process with a simple force field, the Hooke's law force, is nothing more than the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process. And then we want to generalize from a random walk at a point, which is moving up and down in small increments, to random walks in a continuum. And that gives us the theory of Markov random fields. And so we can write a moment-generating function for Markov random fields in which now we've got a field quantity phi, which is basically the random walk at the point x at time t. And this thing is a field that varies over the entire cortical sheet, if you like, or cortical slab. And now the action generalizes to from that. And now this del phi squared thing, that's a generalized derivative that includes both time and space coordinates. And we have to do a little bit of rescaling in the thing, too. And again, the two-point correlation function for a Markov random field is obtained from the solution of a PDE this time, the Helmholtz equation. And since we're going to the Helmholtz meeting after this, it's appropriate. And what you find is then, so this summarizes the sort of basis. We're going to show, we've shown that we can describe Gaussian-Markov random walks and fields in terms of their associated Green's functions. And what we want to do then is to do neural dynamics in exactly the same way. Okay, so let's see how we do it. And this addresses Terry's question that he raised. So we take the cycle of depolarization, action potential, and after hyperpolarization of a neuron, and we quantize that into three states. So the three states that we're going to work with are the subthreshold depolarized state, which we call the quiescent state, the state when there's an action potential being produced, that's the active state. And then we have the subthreshold hyperpolarized state or refractory state. So indeed, we've created a little spin system, but it's got three states rather than two states. We could reduce it to the two-state case, and we will do a little bit. And so we have to specify the kinetics of this model, the transitions from the quiescent to the active, and we can get a transition from the refractory back to the active, but the threshold for that is much higher. So f of q is the rate at which neurons produce spikes, and the q is the there's a current threshold for that from the quiescent state, and the rate fr is the same function but with the threshold from the refractory state. Alpha is the decay rate of spikes, and that's equal to the inverse of the width of an action potential, which is about a millisecond. So alpha is about a kilohertz. And beta is the time spent in the relative refractory state, which can be much smaller a rate than alpha, because neurons can spend quite a long time in the refractory state. Okay. So we can calculate the input current by adding up all the contributions from all the other active neurons in the network, which are connected to a particular neuron through the weighting function W, and H is an external stimulus. And the firing rate function is a function of the ratio of the input current divided by the threshold current. And we'll assume them to be monotonic functions and the functions are smooth enough that the derivative at the threshold is finite. So we can't quite handle a model in which there's a discontinuous firing rate function at threshold within this framework. But I actually have thought up another modification, a model too, where we can do. So now we want to introduce our neural master equation. We want to do the bookkeeping here that allows us to write down an answer. And what we do then is we look at what happens in a very small time interval delta t. And we make the Kolmogorov assumption that the chances of more than one transition occurring in time delta t scales with delta t. So as we let delta t go to zero, the chances of more than one spike a transition occurring in the network gets smaller and smaller. So this means that we're dealing at the moment anyway with asynchronous updating. If we have synchronous updating, we get a different kind of master equation, which I can write down, but I haven't explored yet. It'll give a somewhat different theory, but not too much. So the transitions that can occur in the network are either nothing changes, system sitting at equilibrium, or a quiescent neuron is activated, a refractory neuron is activated, an activated neuron becomes refractory, or a refractory neuron becomes quiescent. And we know that QAR, the total numbers of in these states, that must sum to the total number of neurons in the network. So we have that. We can eliminate one of these quantities. So now to proceed further, we need the right kind of mathematical representation for all of this. So in 1978, I actually developed all this without the right kind of mathematical representation, just doing it from a master equation approach. And then I took the Fokker-Planck limit of the master equation and got Fokker-Planck equations for it, but I considered them uninteresting, and I never published this stuff. A few years later, the same thing was published by Ginsburg and Sumpolinski, but I always felt it wasn't very interesting. But let me go back. So we introduce this representation now, the right way to do this. We just use a standard vector basis for the three states. And that means in order to move from Q to A and A to R and so on, we have to have matrices that act on the vectors to produce new vectors. In other words, 3x3 matrices. It turns out that the matrices that are needed to do this are constructed from Murray-Gell-Mann's matrices for the representation of the Lie group SU3. The algebra of neuron, the three-state neuron, is the same as the algebra of quarks. This is a pure coincidence, but it's very interesting. And so if we actually do that, we get, here are the eight famous Gell-Mann matrices of the theory of quarks. And if you look at complex combinations of them, you get what are called raising and lowering operators. So if you know anything about the solutions of second-order linear differential equations, ODEs, you know that you can take the eigenfunctions of those things, and they're indexed by parameters, and you can find an operator that raises or lowers the parameter of the eigenfunctions. And that's what these things are. And so your combinations of these actually give you a state transition diagram like this, which mimics the one that I introduced, the QAR one. And so we know that we can actually write down an algebraic formulation of our master equation using these raising and lowering operators. This took me a while to understand, but it's actually very straightforward. So now we put our neurons into a d-dimensional lattice. We've got n neurons, and we have a neural state vector then. And I'm using the Dirac notation for vectors here. So new I means the neuron at the ith lattice point is in the state QA or R. So that means there are 3 to the n possible configurations in our network. And if there are 10 to the 10th neurons in that network, we have 3 times 10 to the 10th possible configurations to sum over, which is a big number. And now we associate with each of those configurations a probability. And then we sum over all the those weighted configurations with their probabilities, and that gives us the probability state vector. Okay, but we know that that probability, those probabilities must sum to one. So here's the difference between quantum mechanics and neuron mechanics. That is that normalization. The sum of the probabilities goes to one. In quantum mechanics, it would be the sum of the square of the modulus of the of these functions would go to one. That's the wave equation. Okay. So now we can count with these with this algebra, because if I take, let's go back to the previous picture. If I take lambda minus 2 and I apply that to a configuration, it will take all the active neurons and make them refractory, and it will kill everything else, makes them all zero. Okay. And then if I act on that with lambda plus 2, all the refractory neurons will go into the active state, and everything else will not produce anything. So that pair of operations, one after the other, will count the number of neurons in the refractory state in the network. It's a number density operator. Similarly for the Q state and so on. And so I can actually count the number of active neurons in the network by these number density operators. I can do that for, and I can do that for the current, the total excitation coming into the network as well. I can count it by weighting the number density of active states by the weighting function for each active neuron. And that means I can rewrite the master equation as a neural Hamiltonian, an evolution operator, which counts all the possible state transitions in and out of the states, and also you have to add terms that conserve the probability so that the probabilities all sum to one. So this is just a very neat algebraic way of writing down the master equation for our 10 to the 10th neurons in the neocortex. As I say, it's a lot of formalism, but it actually is very useful. It's exactly the right way to do things. And so I can write down basically the analog of the second quantized form of the Schrödinger equation of quantum field theory for neural networks viewed as Gauss, as Markov processes. So this is the state I'd gotten to by 1991 or so. And I put this into a NIPS volume. I actually had difficulty getting accepted by the NIPS committee, but one of the people there, Todd Lean, stood up for this, and despite objections, he got it into the meeting. So I was able to give a poster on this at NIPS. But of course, it is rather remote from the kind of things that go on at NIPS, so it was understandable that it wouldn't sail through the selection. Now, the point about all this is that if we can now express the solution of this master equation as a path integral, and then we can use the standard methods developed by physicists for evaluating these things. In the last 20 years, what has happened is very interesting. Following up Wick's ideas, physicists have recognized that the Feynman path integrals of quantum field theory are nothing more than Wiener integrals in imaginary time, and therefore you can evaluate them. Because the Wiener integral is mathematically well defined and you can compute with it. It's just Gaussian integrals, whereas the Feynman path integral is actually mathematically not at all well defined at all. But Feynman knew all this. He knew he could calculate with it if he went to imaginary time, but that is now called Euclidean quantum field theory. And so what we're now going to do is apply Euclidean quantum field theory, which is the modern form in which statistical mechanics is done, to neural networks. And this is what took me so many years to figure out how to do it. We're going to proceed further. To go further, then, we need to take the thermodynamic limit. That means n goes to infinity. And also the continuum limit. That means the lattice spacing goes to zero. But in such a way that we get finite densities of neurons. Packing densities now become important, and weighting functions and current densities and all that sort of stuff. But before I do that, for this talk, I'm going to make it simpler. Because I've always been heavily influenced by things I've read about Einstein, and he once said, a theory should be as simple as possible, but no simpler. And so we want to try to establish the principles of this theory by looking at the simplest possible model. And that's the model in which the spike rates are low in a network. The probability of a neuron emitting a spike is low. And if we do that, then we get a theory that is very interesting. So recall that capital A of t is the number of spiking neurons in the network at time t. In the continuum limit, we can rewrite that as the integral over all space of the packing density of neurons multiplied by the fraction of spiking neurons in the volume element at time t. And then we can connect it with what Hugh Wilson and I introduced, that A is nothing more than the integral over the width of the action potential of the rate at which neurons become active. And similarly, R of t, the number in the refractory neurons, is the spatial integral over the refractory period of the fraction of neurons which spiked at time t prime, which are still in the refractory state at time t. So we can count that, too. And what that means is that the fraction in the refractory state is the integral of that function over one refractory period. And that means the total number of quiescent neurons is 1 minus those two other quantities. At low spike rates, we can actually make the approximation that q is at close to 1. In other words, almost all the neurons in the network are in the quiescent state, and a few of them are popping up. And that means we can neglect the complexity that we looked at before. We can treat the q equal 1 state as a vacuum, and we're going to create neurons out of that vacuum, beginning to look like solid state physics now, which it is. And so we can actually reduce our state transition diagram to this thing. We've got the vacuum in which all the neurons are in the quiescent state. We create neurons out of the vacuum at a rate f, and then the spikes disappear at a rate alpha back into the vacuum. And so now we get a much simpler neural Hamiltonian, the spike Hamiltonian, that we can write down immediately. So this is the object we want to play with. Okay, now, what took me so long is all summarized in this page. In order to actually derive the right form of the moment-generating function, you have to go through a complex process. I had to find exactly the right representations of it. And what I found are what are called coherent states. They were first recognized by Schrödinger in 1926, fairly quickly after he introduced the wave equation. They are functions that are essentially retain their form under the action of the Schrödinger equation. And that's why they were called by Roy Glauber in his work on quantum optics. They were called coherent states. They're things that don't change their state, their shape, basically, under the action of the evolution of the wave equation. It turns out those are the best representation to use for expressing all these statistics of in quantum field theory and also for Markov random fields. But it took me a long time, and it turns out there are all kinds of coherent states. There are coherent states that are very simple, the algebra of which is just the Lie group U1. There are other ones which are Kolmogorov. So I thought the appropriate coherent states would be ones that express the Lie algebra SU3. But it turns out that for this reduced model, the appropriate coherent states are the simplest ones, the ones that were introduced by Wigner, which have a U1 symmetry with them. And when you do that, you get exactly the right theory. So here's the moment-generating function written in terms of these coherent states, phi. It's a complex quantity, so it has a complex conjugate, phi star. And so you get what's called a coherent state path integral for the moment-generating function for this process. And that's what the upper formula is. And now the action, for the neural action, the analog of t plus v in the random walk case, is written down below. And I've included in the action the initial condition. So the initially, the neurons are, there's a distribution function P of X at time T0 for the states of all the neurons in the network. And that can be a Poisson distribution or it can be anything. But there is the action. And H is the coherent state Hamiltonian for our network, and that can be written in terms of these coherent states in a certain way. And I say here that phi and its complex conjugate are eigenfunctions of the evolution equation that we've been working with. So this bit is actually what took me about 10 years to understand. So don't worry if you don't understand it just from looking at the formulas. Okay, so now we linearize the model. Suppose we let the quantity that appears in the action, we call that S. And we're going to linearize F of S about a threshold current. Under those conditions, we can rewrite the action in a simpler form. And the point about it is that the only terms that appear in the action are at most quadratic. That means we can solve everything exactly because the only integrals that need to be computed are Gaussian integrals. And as you all know, you can calculate Gaussian integrals. If we do that, we find that we can write down the Green's function exactly for the linearized spiking model. And we know that the Green's function is equal to the two-point, two-space correlation function for the network. So immediately we have an explicit formula for the two-point correlation function in frequency space, in Fourier space, or momentum space, as physicists say, for this network. In the first case, it's when there's no applied current, IA. In the second case, we have a current. And this is neat because this contains all the statistics of the network. So we've completely solved the linearized network problem. And in general, the effect of a stimulus is large compared to the effects of the network on neurons. So to first order, the correlation function is linear in the applied current. Yes. And I say in general, as t goes to infinity, this propagator actually approximates the propagator of a Brownian motion, the diffusion limit of a random walk. So in other words, here's the proof that at long timescales, the neural network dynamics, it really looks like that of a reaction diffusion system, which is something I've been using in these Turing analysis of these spontaneous pattern formations, things that I talked about yesterday. But this nails it down. This shows it. It's explicit. Now what's interesting is that as long as the weighting function is spatially homogeneous, the action given above exactly represents a branching process. So mathematically, what a branching process is, you have some neuron, it spikes, it gives rise to two neurons spiking, and they give rise to four, and so on. You get a little avalanche. This action actually explicitly describes such an avalanche. And when alpha equals F prime at threshold times W naught, where W naught is the total number of synaptic contacts on the neuron, the net number over excitatory minus inhibitory, then you should get critical branching. So right away, you can deduce from this network analysis of spiking neurons that at least in the linear approximation, it describes branching process. It's characterized as a branching process. And you get critical branching out of it if it's balanced between excitation and inhibition.
The sort of propagation let's see, who was it? Israel, who's working on.
It's not Segev, it's Beggs and Plants.
No. The fellow who sees patterns of spikes in the cortex. Forgot his name.
Abelis?
Abelis, yeah.
No, it's different.
It's different. It's actually different from Abelis. He doesn't have.
Beggs and Plants.
Beggs and Plants actually have. And I'll come to that.
Jacob.
I'll come to the data.
In tissue culture.
Yeah, that's right. In culture. Now, what about the nonlinear model? Incidentally, your little model might be very useful here. I just realized thinking about it. That would be very useful. In more realistic neural models, the firing rate function is nonlinear. So what we have to do is do a power series expansion of this firing or probability function, F. And what that means is very interesting. The action isn't quadratic anymore, and so we must use the perturbation methods of quantum field theory to do the calculation. But unless it's done properly, you get mathematical problems because you get non-uniform expansions out of it. And as mathematicians know, you have to be very careful about that. And what you really need are singular perturbation techniques. What physicists worked out over the years is what is called the renormalization group methods for doing that. And it was only Nigel Goldenfeld, a postdoctoral fellow then of Leo Kadanoff, my colleague at Chicago, who realized that what physicists call the renormalization group method is nothing more than singular perturbation in applied mathematics. And so what Michael Bice and I did was to apply these techniques to the action that we have. And the problem is that you get multiple time and space scales in nonlinear dynamics problems. You must take account of those changes in the time scales and the space scales in your calculations. Otherwise, you get things going completely haywire. So what you have to do is you have to do a standard singular perturbation analysis, and what you do then is you end up with a new action which takes account of the fact that there are near critical points there are long time scales and long length scales to be taken account of. The net effect of that is that the action changes, and you end up with a renormalized neural action. And now you have a diffusion term in there. That's because at long time scales, the neural networks look like reaction diffusion equations. So D, mu, and G are renormalized constants in the system. So this is the correct action required to calculate and get finite results from a nonlinear neural network. Okay, but then comes something really interesting. It turns out that that action is exactly the action of what is called region field theory, which was an action introduced by a Russian physicist called Gribov to represent some parts of high-energy particle physics. Incidentally, Henri Abarbanel at UCSD has done a lot of work on region field theory. And then Cardy and Sugar at UCSD about a decade ago showed that it corresponds, but John Cardy was at UCSD when they did this stuff. But it turns out that the behavior of such a system corresponds to both branching and aggregation. So now you have two neurons, and then one of them annihilates, and you get one. So you get processes that expand into an avalanche and then collapse again. It's because the neuron firing rates are saturating. You get that kind of effect. In the case of the dynamics is critical, when the decay of the spiking is equal to the gain of the firing rate function times the number of synapses on per neuron, then Cardy and Sugar showed that in such systems, they have a universal non-equilibrium phase transition, and it's in a class that corresponds to what is called directed percolation. In a percolation process, percolation is when you have a graph or a network, and you have a point, and it goes to another point, and it takes paths through the system. Directed percolation is when there's only one direction. It can't go back along the path. And so what we've shown then is that there's a universal phase transition in neural networks, in nonlinear neural networks, called the directed percolation phase transition, the DP phase transition. So balanced or equilibrium states of a neural network should exhibit a DP phase transition when such states are destabilized. Well away from such states, you get mean field behavior. So well away from these critical points, Wilson-Cowan equations exactly describe what's going on. And in fact, the mean field version of this theory is the Wilson-Cowan theory at low firing rates. So it actually fits together. It is the correct generalization of what I did with Wilson, and it's taken me 30-odd years to find it. And then Michael was able to prove a very interesting condition. It's an analog of what's called the Ginsberg condition, which was done by Ginsberg. He's the Ginsberg of Landau-Ginsberg, in superconductivity. And this is a condition for the emergence of the DP phase transition. And the condition is that the ratio of the W2 over W0, so W0 is the total number of synaptic weights on a neuron, the net difference between excitatory and inhibitory synaptic weights. W2 is the space constant associated with the width of the length scale of the connectivity divided by the total number. The square of that needs to be much larger than the second derivative of the firing rate function times W0 times a constant divided by the first derivative of the firing rate function times the diffusion length for the spread of the activity raised to the power 4 minus d. So here you get the famous upper critical dimension of 4 here appearing in this story, just like it does in superconductivity. If this condition isn't violated, then critical branching without aggregation occurs. So depending upon the parameters of the network, the space constants of the network, you might get just critical branching, or you might get critical branching plus aggregation, which is directed percolation. But what that means is that all the exponents that are close to the critical point, that phase transition tells you what the exponents are, what the power laws are that you should see in the dynamics. So here's a few observations, and then I will close. So Beggs and Plentz did cortical slice preparations. Now, normally, as Terry pointed out, these things are hyperpolarized. You have to actually depolarize them a little bit to get them to start spiking. If you do that, what they found was they found little avalanches of spiking neurons, and basically branching. And when they measured the statistics of their avalanches, they found that the number of avalanches of a given size scaled as a power law with an exponent of -3/2. If you calculate the propagator here, the Green's function for critical branching in our theory, it has an exponent of -3/2. It exactly characterizes what you find in tissue culture slices when they're slightly depolarized. In other words, they're brought into the balance condition that Sednovsky and Sodix discussed in their paper on the large fluctuations. So Koch and Sofsky saw that there were large fluctuations in spontaneous firing. Well, this is exactly what you would predict if you're sitting about a DP phase transition critical point. So it actually fits together. And we can characterize what the power laws look like there. So mine and Sepsnovsky's, if you look at your data, if you were to measure the power laws, I bet you would find these critical exponents in there. Segev and company also have found power laws in their tissue cultures, and they found essentially 1 over F noise spectra for their interspike interval distributions. Many people have measured what are called Fano factors. That's the ratio of the variance to the mean of the activity as a function of the bin width that they use. If you use bigger and bigger bin widths, you get a scaling law out of the Fano factor, which has a slope of 1. And that exactly corresponds to the propagator, the behavior of our propagator in the field theory. And finally, the power spectrum of spike counts near criticality in the field theory turns out to be proportional to 1 over F squared. But that implies that the interspike interval spectrum is proportional to 1 over F. So you get 1 over F noise spectra close to criticality in these networks. And this corresponds exactly to what Davidson and Schuster showed for a single neuron. They showed that if you have a single neuron and the threshold isn't resetting after the neuron spikes, but it's just Brownian motion that persists through the spiking, then the spectrum of the interspike interval activity is 1 over F. What we are here showing is that from the field theory, it's the effect of all the other neurons in the network that's providing the Brownian motion that produces the 1 over F power spectrum at criticality. So in other words, we can begin now to really account for all this stuff. Now, something I didn't mention on the slide is the other characteristic of a phase transition. The length scales and the time scales. The time scales get slower and the length scales get bigger at a critical phase transition. So what does that mean? It means that long-range correlations appear in the network close to a phase transition. So this means that we can begin to interpret what will go on if the nervous system is indeed sitting in a balanced condition because of attention mechanisms. And when you stimulate it, or when it spontaneously goes unstable, long-range correlated activity should appear in the network. Not only that, if you look at the structure of the action function here, if you build in the stimulus as a coherent state rather than just a deterministic quantity, then you can produce a stimulus which has no components, no variation in the mean, and yet it will still drive the system because it's got correlations. So Sednovsky and Salinas showed an example of how you might do that in their review paper. This calculation shows that indeed it can happen in a neural network. The only things that enter into the story are the weight function, the total weight on the neuron, the net difference between excitation and inhibition, the length constant of the connectivity, the slope of the firing rate function, the second derivative of the firing rate function, and more or less that's it. And those are the only things you need to be able to calculate all these quantities. Not only that, this model also applies to voltages as well as to spikes. So EEG phenomena, evoked potentials, all people have measured Fano factors, Hurst exponents, covariance functions, stuff like that. It all can be analyzed by the methods introduced here. Okay, that's enough. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, so, speaking as an experimentalist who used to do particle physics, I have a suspicion that your symmetry group is way too simple. Because there's more and more recent evidence that circuits span neurons and that a single neuron can participate in multiple circuits and stuff like that. So if you change your symmetry group from SU3 to something much, much more complicated, how do all the components...
Will make any difference.
Will make any difference.
No, it won't. And there's a very interesting long review article by a man called Hinrichsen, about a 200-page review on directed percolation phase non-equilibrium phase transitions, indicates that if you have noise in the network, so you have connection noise. So if you have quenched spatial disorder, only quenched spatial disorder, it'll destroy the universality of the phase transition. You get a phase transition, but it's not a DP phase transition. It has different exponents. If you have temporal disorder in the network, it will also destroy the DP phase transition. However, if you have spatiotemporal disorder, it will preserve the DP phase transition. So if you have neurons that are, if you have a lot of disorder in the network, spatial disorder, but you have synaptic plasticity and you have changes that are occurring both in space and time in the network, it will not affect the DP phase transition.
At the level of neuron is kind of misleading because one is at any level, some neuronal scale that you pick.
Well, this quantization is the simplest one. You could have more complex models. The point is you'll still get these effects, the action. But when you renormalize the action, basically all the terms drop out except the ones that are here. So it doesn't actually matter. This is a universal property of neuron networks.
So, just to follow up, you assume that the W matrix is fixed, right?
Right.
What if there's short-term plasticity?
Well, so I've actually started to study that, and Bert Kappers, who you probably know, he produced a very interesting paper recently indicating that if you look at the literature of optimal control, if you have a control process, you can express the action of an optimal control on a dynamical system as a path integral. I've been finding ways to use that, to combine that result with this and add a control constraint to this setup. Now, if you have synapses of the time for type, for example, studied by Sasha Nelson, which have a feedback mechanism in the, so the synapse gets weaker when the activity is strong and gets stronger when the activity is weak. That provides a control mechanism, and you can add synaptic plasticity to this story and see that you get modified action. And that led me to think that maybe that's how some of Per Beck's ideas can be embodied in networks, that you do indeed, might indeed get a self-tuning system out of that if it's set, if it's tuned to a particular operating point.
That's on a longer time scale.
Yeah.
There is the self-adjusting, it reaches the criticality.
Yeah, right.
But what about shorter time scale, like short-term synaptic facilitation or depression,
well,
which is occurring on a time scale of seconds? Or
well, that's what Sasha was talking about. Yeah.
Hours and days.
Well, he was talking about this lower, the fast stuff, in my understanding.
Well,
but it's.
But the, right. The, let's
set fast time scale. Yeah.
It's happening on a second time scale, but there's the network is readjusting to.
Yeah. Right. And so you could put in. So at the moment, W goes in as a constant function, but it would be easy to make it an operator. And once you make it an operator, it's true, you get a more complex Hamiltonian. So it might well change the action. It'll change the action, all right. But it might not change the renormalized action very, very much. So it might still have these properties. If it doesn't have these properties, it'll have some other phase transition properties that are interesting.
Is there a place for excitatory and inhibitory neurons?
Yes, yeah. I mean, again, at the moment, I've just lumped the two together, so the weighting function is the difference between the two. It's a Mexican hat. But it's easy enough to extend the thing to a vector representation in which you have populations of excitatory and inhibitory neurons and do the whole thing. And you could put different time constants in for them. So then you would get a Green's function, which is no longer a single exponential, but you something that's more complicated, and pretty soon you'll have all kinds of stuff. So that's what I meant when I was thinking about your little model, actually. It would be straightforward to build this into the thing. So this is just the simplest possible theory, but it already is very rich. And so my philosophy is always to try and learn things by looking at the simplest theory and let other people add things to it, the bells and whistles, that make it better and better fit to the data. But I don't really care about the data. I care about the the elegance of the formulation. I shouldn't really say that here, but I'm driven by the theoretical ideas, not by the experimental ideas.
So the so you're thinking about applying it to the cortex, right?
Yeah. It could also be applied to thalamic circuitry as well, or thalamocortical circuitry, and all kinds of things. And combining this with the stuff I talked about yesterday is a very interesting thought that needs a lot of work, but I believe there's a lot of things can be done with this.
So what do you think is happening during sleep? When clearly the system changes, it's no longer in this, desynchronized state, it's in a state where it's
right.
Much more coherent,
right.
Globally coherent.
Right.
So there must be a whole set of different...
There are a whole set of different formulations of master equations that take account of differences in the updating scheme and all sorts of stuff like that need to be explored. But this machinery is universal. You can do these things within this framework. The point is you can actually study fluctuations and correlations now and the way they interact with the nonlinear stuff and get the dynamics of it.
And because you've made the Gaussian assumption, then yeah. All you need to look is two-point correlation.
Right, right. And which is the guts of quantum field theory as well. It's the same thing. Now, if it's non-Gaussian, then you have to perturb it and you have to figure out ways of doing it. That's much harder. But my guess is the Gaussian Markov thing gets you an extremely long way. Everything else is a perturbation from this case.
Okay, well, let's thank the speaker again.